This recording of AA Comes of Age includes chapters 1 through 6 only. Not included on this recording are landmarks in AA history, the foreword, and the appendices. Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. Copyright 1957 by Alcoholics Anonymous Publishing Incorporated, now known as AA World Services Incorporated. All rights reserved. First printing, 1957. Reading from the 11th printing of 1984. This is AA General Service Conference Approved Literature. Chapter 1, When AA Came of Age, by Bill W., co-founder, Alcoholics Anonymous. During the first 3 days of July 1955, Alcoholics Anonymous held a convention in St. Louis, commemorating the 20th anniversary of its founding. There, our fellowship declared itself come to the age of full responsibility, and there it received from its founders and old-timers permanent keeping of its three great legacies of recovery, unity, and service. I will always remember those 3 days as among the greatest experiences of my life. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the final day, about 5,000 AA members and their families and friends were seated in the Kiel Auditorium at St. Louis. All of the United States and Canadian provinces were represented. Some had traveled from far lands to be there. On the auditorium stage were the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, including some 75 delegates from the United States and Canada, trustees of AA's General Service Board, directors and secretarial staffs of our World Services at New York, my wife Lois, my mother, and I. The General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous was about to take over the custody of AA's 12 traditions and the guardianship of its world services. It was to be named as the permanent successor to the founders of AA. Speaking for co-founder Dr. Bob and for AA's old-timers everywhere, I made the delivery of the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous to our whole society and its representative conference. From that time, AA went on its own to serve God's purpose for so long as it was destined, under His providence, to endure. Many events in the days preceding had led up to this moment. The total effect was that 5,000 people got a vision of AA such as they had never known before. They were exposed to the main outlines of AA history. With some of us oldsters, they relived the exciting experiences that led to the creation of the 12 Steps of Recovery and the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They heard how the AA traditions were beaten out on the anvils of group experience. They got the story of how AA had established beachheads in 70 foreign lands. And when they saw AA's affairs delivered entirely into their own hands, they experienced a new realization of each individual's responsibility for the whole. At the convention, it was widely appreciated for the first time that nobody had invented Alcoholics Anonymous, that many streams of influence and many people, some of them non-alcoholics, had helped, by the grace of God, to achieve AA's purpose. Several of our non-alcoholic friends of medicine, of religion, and of AA's Board of Trustees had come all the hot and dusty way to St. Louis to share that happy occasion and to tell us about their own experience of participation in the growth of AA. There were men like clergyman Sam Shoemaker, whose early teachings did so much to inspire Dr. Bob and me. There was the beloved Father Dowling, whose personal inspiration and whose recommendation of AA to the world did so much to make our society what it is. Here a footnote informs Father Dowling died in 1960. And there was Dr. Harry Thibault, our first friend of psychiatry, who very early began to use AA concepts in his own practice, and whose good humor, humility, penetrating insight, and courage have meant so much to all of us. Here a footnote denotes Dr. Thibault died in 1966. It was Dr. Thibault, helped by Dr. Kirby Collier of Rochester and Dwight Anderson of New York, who persuaded the Medical Society of the State of New York in 1944, and later the American Psychiatric Association in 1949, to let me, a layman, read papers about AA at their annual gatherings, thus hastening the acceptance of the then little-known AA by physicians all over the globe. The value of Dr. Tebow's contribution then and since is beyond calculation. When we first met Harry, he was serving as chief psychiatrist at one of America's finest sanitariums. His professional skill was widely recognized by patients and colleagues alike. At that time, the modern art of psychiatry was just passing out of its youth and had begun to claim worldwide attention as one of the great advances of our times. The process of exploring the mysteries and motives of the unconscious mind of man was already in full swing. Naturally, the explorers, representing the several schools of psychiatry, were in considerable disagreement respecting the real meaning of the new discoveries, while the followers of Carl Jung saw value, meaning, and reality in religious faith, the great majority of psychiatrists in that day did not. They mostly held to Sigmund Freud's view that religion was a comforting fantasy of man's immaturity, and that when he grew up in the light of modern knowledge, he would no longer need such support. This was the background against which, in 1939, Dr. Harry had seen two spectacular AA recoveries among his own patients. These patients, Marty and Granny, had been the toughest kind of customers, both as alcoholics and as neurotics. When, after a brief exposure to AA, they abruptly stopped drinking, for good, by the way, and at once began to show an astonishing change in outlook and attitude, Harry was electrified. He was also agreeably astonished when he discovered that as a psychiatrist, he could now really reach them, despite the fact that only a few weeks previously, they had presented stone walls of obstinate resistance to his every approach. To Harry, these were facts, brand new facts. Scientist and man of courage that he is, Harry faced them squarely, and not always in the privacy of his office either. As soon as he became fully convinced, he held up AA for his profession and for the public to see. At very considerable risk to his professional standing, Harry Tebow, ever since, has continued to endorse AA and its work to the psychiatric profession. Dr. Tebow was paired on the convention's medical panel with Dr. W.W. Bauer of the American Medical Association, who held out the hand of friendship to AA and recommended us warmly. These good medical friends were not in the least surprised at the testimony of Dr. Earl M., the AA member of the panel. A notable in medical circles from coast to coast, Dr. Earl flatly stated that despite his medical knowledge, which included psychiatry, he had nevertheless been obliged humbly to learn his AA from a butcher. Thus, he confirmed all that Dr. Harry had told us about the necessity of reducing the alcoholic's ballooning ego before entering AA and afterward. The inspiring talks of these doctors reminded us of all the help that AA's friends in medicine had given us over the years. Many AA's at the convention had been at the San Francisco Opera House on the evening in 1951 when Alcoholics Anonymous received the Lasker Award, the gift of Albert and Mary Lasker from the 12,000 physicians of the American Public Health Association. The addresses which the Reverend Samuel Shoemaker, Father Edward Dowling, Dr. Harry Tebow, and Dr. W.W. Bauer made before the convention can be read beginning on page 235 of this book. A footnote informs here that the Reverend Sam Shoemaker died in 1963. Along with them, we published the talk of another friend, Bernard B. Smith, the New York lawyer who has served us so faithfully and brilliantly in recent years as chairman of AA's Board of Trustees. He will be remembered forever as the non-alcoholic whose singular skill and ability to reconcile different viewpoints were deciding factors in the formation of the General Service Conference upon which AA's future so heavily depends. Like the other speakers, Bernard Smith tells not only what AA means to alcoholics and to the world at large, but also what AA principles, as practiced in his own life, have meant to him. Several other of our old-time friends made inspiring contributions to the gathering. Their talks, indeed all of the St. Louis meetings, were recorded on tapes in full and thus are available. And here the book informs that these tapes are no longer available. We regret that the limited compass of this volume does not permit the inclusion of all of them here. On the very first day of the convention, for example, one of AA's oldest and most valued friends, Mr. Leonard V. Harrison, chaired a session called AA and Industry. Leonard, who is still a trustee, has endeared himself to us over a period of more than 10 years' service on our board. He preceded Bernard Smith as our board chairman, and he saw AA through its frightfully wobbly time of adolescence, a time when nobody could say whether our society would hang together or blow up entirely. What his wise counsel and steady hand meant to us of AA in that stormy period is quite beyond telling. Mr. Harrison then introduced a newer friend, Henry A. Mielkarek, who is engaged by Alice Chalmers to look after the alcoholic problem in that great company. Ably seconded by Dave, an AA member holding a similar position at DuPont, Mr. Mielkarek opened the eyes of the audience to the possibilities of the application of AA and its principles in industry. Our vision of AA in industry was taken a step further by the final speaker, Dr. John L. Norris of the Eastman Kodak Company. He had come to the convention in a double role. One of the pioneers in the introduction of AA into industry, he was also a longtime trustee on AA's General Service Board, a most selfless and devoted worker. Again, those of us who sat in the audience ask ourselves, what would we have ever done without friends like these? During the second day of the convention, there was a meeting on AA in institutions. The speakers took us on a journey into what were once the two darkest pits in which the alcoholic could suffer, the prison and the mental hospital. We were told how a new hope and a new light had entered these places of one-time darkness. Most of us were astounded when we learned the extent of the AA penetration, with groups today in 265 hospitals and 335 prisons throughout the world. Here is a footnote. These figures as of 1957. In 1984, there are over 1,300 groups in correctional facilities and more than 1,000 in treatment facilities in the U.S. and Canada alone. Formerly, only about 20% of the alcoholic parolees from institutions and prisons ever made the grade. But since the advent of AA, 80% of these parolees have found permanent freedom. Two AAs sparked this panel, and here again our faithful non-alcoholic friends were represented. There was Dr. O. Arnold Kilpatrick, psychiatrist in charge of a New York State mental institution, who told us of the wonderful progress of AA in his hospital. He was followed by Mr. Austin McCormick, one-time commissioner of correction in New York City, and now a professor of criminology at the University of California. Here was an old-time friend indeed, a kind and devoted fellow worker who had served a considerable hitch as a trustee in the days of AA's Alcoholic Foundation. When he moved west, it was California's gain and a corresponding loss to AA's headquarters. And now here he was again, telling how he had kept in touch with prison authorities throughout America. As Dr. Kilpatrick had confirmed AA's progress in mental institutions, so Austin McCormick, with an authority born of experience, reported the steadily increasing influence of AA groups in prisons. Again, our vision was extended and our spirits were kindled. During the convention, many just plain AA meetings were held. At those meetings and in the corridors, coffee shops, and hotel rooms, we were continually and gratefully thoughtful of our friends and of all the providence had appointed them to do for us. Our thoughts often went out to those who were not there, those who had passed on, those who were ill, and those who just couldn't make it. Among the latter, we sorely miss trustees Jack Alexander, Frank Amos, Dr. Leonard Strong Jr., and Frank Golden. Most of all, of course, we talked about co-founder Dr. Bob and his wife, Anne. A handful of us could recall those first days in 1935 at Akron, where the spark that was to become the first AA group was struck. Some of us could retell tales that had been told in Dr. Bob's living room in their house on Ardmore Avenue, and we could remember Anne as she sat in a corner by the fireplace, reading from the Bible the warning of James, that faith without works is dead. Indeed, we had with us at the convention young Bob and Sister Sue, who had seen the beginnings of AA's first group. Sue's husband, Ernie, AA number 4, was there too. And old Bill D, AA number 3, was represented by his widow, Henrietta. We were all overjoyed to see Ethel, the longest sober lady of the Akron-Cleveland region, whose moving story can now be read in the second edition of the AA book. She reminded us of all the early Akron veterans, a dozen and a half of them, whose stories were the backbone of the first edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and who, together with Dr. Bob, had created the first AA group in the world. As the stories unfolded, we saw Dr. Bob entering the doors of St. Thomas Hospital, the first religious hospital to receive prospective members of AA for treatment on a regular basis. Here there developed that great partnership between Dr. Bob and the incomparable Sister Ignatia of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine. A footnote here informs that Sister Ignatia died in 1966. Her name brings to mind the classic story about the first drunk she and Dr. Bob treated. Sister Ignatia's night supervisor wasn't very keen about alcoholics, especially the DT variety, and Dr. Bob had arrived with a request for a private room for his first customer. Sister Ignatia said to him, "Doctor, we do not have any beds, much less private rooms, but I will do what I can." And then into the hospital's flower room, she slyly bootlegged AA's first jittering candidate for admission. From this uncertain start of hospitalization in our pioneering time, we watch the growing procession of alcoholic sufferers as they pass through the doors of St. Thomas and out into the world again, most of them never to return to the hospital except as visitors. From 1939 to the time Dr. Bob took his leave of us in 1950, over 5,000 had thus been treated. And so the ministry of Dr. Bob, his wife Anne, Sister Ignatia, and Akron's early timers set an example for the practice of AA's 12 steps that will remain for all time. This great tradition lives on in the person of Sister Ignatia. She continues her labor of love today at Cleveland's St. Vincent Charity Hospital, where grateful AAs of that area have contributed labor and money to reconstruct an old wing of the place, which has been christened Rosary Hall and set aside for the special use of the sister and her co-workers. Already, 5,000 cases have been treated. The footnote says, as of 1957. Many an AA member today believes that among the best gateways to sobriety are the alcoholic wards of the religious hospitals that cooperate with us. Surely those who have passed through St. Thomas at Akron and St. Vincent's Charity at Cleveland will heartily agree with this. It is our hope that in due time, religious hospitals of all denominations will follow the example of these great originals. What Sister Ignatia and her associates at St. Thomas have already done is a very brave beginning. But the future may honor them even more for the great works that their example set in motion. In 1949, 10 years after the start of Dr. Bob's and Sister Ignatia's pioneering, the importance of this work was deeply realized by AAs throughout Ohio. A committee was formed to place a plaque in the alcoholic ward at St. Thomas Hospital, a memorial which would clearly show what so many of us really thought and felt. I was asked to write the inscription and preside at the dedication. Though Anne had recently passed away, Dr. Bob could still be with us. Characteristically, Sister Ignatia would not let her name appear on the inscription. It was on Saturday afternoon, April 8, 1949, that we unveiled and presented the memorial plaque to the hospital. Its inscription read as follows: "In gratitude, The friends of Dr. Bob and Ann S. affectionately dedicate this memorial to the sisters and staff of St. Thomas Hospital. At Akron, birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous, St. Thomas Hospital became the first religious institution ever to open its door to our society. May the loving devotion of those who labored here in our pioneering time be a bright and wondrous example of God's grace everlastingly set before us all. Everyone remembers Dr. Bob's famous final admonition to Alcoholics Anonymous, "Let's not louse this thing up. Let's keep it simple." And I recall my own tribute in the AA grapevine to his great simplicity and strength. Serenely remarking to his attendant, "I think this is it," Dr. Bob passed out of our sight and hearing November 16, 1950, at noonday. So ended the consuming malady in the course of which he had shown us how high faith can rise over grievous distress. As he had lived, so he died, supremely aware that in his Father's house are many mansions. Among all those he knew, memory was at flood tide. But who could really say what was thought and felt by the 5,000 sick ones to whom he personally ministered and freely gave a physician's care? Who could possibly record the reflections of his townsmen who had seen him sink almost into oblivion, then rise to anonymous world renown? Who could express the gratitude of those tens of thousands of AA families who had so often heard of him but had never seen him face to face? And what were the emotions of those nearest him as they thankfully pondered the mystery of his regeneration 15 years before and all its vast consequence since? Only the smallest fraction of this great blessing could be comprehended. We could only say, "What indeed hath God wrought?" Never would Dr. Bob have us think him a saint or a superman, nor would he have us praise him or grieve his passing. We can almost hear him saying to us, "Seems to me you folks are making heavy going. I'm not to be taken so seriously as all that. I was only a first link in that chain of providential circumstances which is called AA. By grace and good fortune, my link did not break, though my faults and failures often might have brought on that unhappy result. I was just another alcoholic trying to get along under the grace of God. Forget me, but go you and do likewise. Add your own link to our chain. With God's help, forge that chain well and truly." It was in this manner, if not in these exact words, that Dr. Bob actually did estimate himself and counsel us. Meeting a few months after Dr. Bob's death, the first General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous voted in 1951 to present each of Dr. Bob's heirs, young Bob and Sue, with a scroll which struck a final note. It read as follows: "Dr. Bob, in memoriam. Alcoholics Anonymous herein records its timeless gratitude for the life and works of Dr. Robert Holbrook S., a co-founder. Known in affection as Dr. Bob, he recovered from alcoholism on June 10, 1935. In that year, he helped form the first Alcoholics Anonymous group. This beacon he and his good wife Anne so well tended that its light at length traversed the world. By the day of his departure from us, November 16, 1950, he had spiritually and medically helped countless fellow sufferers. Dr. Bob's was the humility that declines all honors, the integrity that brooks no compromise. His was the devotion to man and God, which in bright example will shine always. The World Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous presents this testament of gratitude to the heirs of Dr. Bob and Ann S." Thinking of the early years in Akron reminded us also of the pioneering days in the East, of the struggle to start AA's group number 2 at New York in the fall of 1935. Earlier in the year, before meeting Dr. Bob, I had worked with many alcoholics. but there had been no success in New York until my return home in September. I told the convention how the idea began to catch on. Of the first meetings in the parlor at 182 Clinton Street, Brooklyn, of the forays to New York's Calvary Mission and Towns Hospital in the feverish search for more prospects, of the sprinkling of those who sobered up, and of the many who dismally flopped. My wife Lois recalled how, for 3 years, our Clinton Street home had been filled from cellar to garret with alcoholics of every description, and how, to our dismay, they skidded back into drink, seeming failures all. Some of them did sober up later on, perhaps in spite of us. Out in Akron, in the houses of Dr. Bob and Wally, the home sobering treatment fared better. In fact, Wally and his wife probably made an all-time high record for home treatment and rehabilitation of AA's newcomers. Their percentage of success was great, and their example was widely followed for a time in the homes of other Akronites. As Lois once said, it was a wonderful laboratory in which we experimented and learned the hard way. I reminded Jerseyites at the convention of early meetings in Upper Montclair and South Orange and in Muncie, New York, when Lois and I moved over there about the time the AA book came off the press in the spring of 1939, after the foreclosure of the Brooklyn home of her parents where we had been living. The weather was warm, and we lived in a summer camp on a quiet lake in western New Jersey, the gracious loan of a good AA friend and his mother. Another friend let us use his car. I recalled how the summer had been spent trying to repair the bankrupt affairs of the AA book, which, money-wise, had failed so dismally after its publication. We had a hard time keeping the sheriff out of our little cubicle of an office at 17 William Street, Newark, where most of the volume had been written. We attended New Jersey's first AA meeting, held in the summer of 1939, at the Upper Montclair house of Henry P., my partner in the now shaky book enterprise. There we met Bob and Mag V., our great friends-to-be. When, at Thanksgiving, snow fell on our summer camp, they invited us to spend the winter with them at their house in Muncie, New York. That winter with Mag and Bob was both rough and exciting. Nobody had any money. Their house was a one-time mansion, gone ramshackle. The furnace and the water pump quit by turns. An earlier member of Mag's family had built an addition of 2 huge rooms, one downstairs and one upstairs, which boasted no heat at all. The upper room was so cold, they called it Siberia. We fixed this with a second-hand coal stove, which cost $3.75. It continually threatened to fall apart, and why we never burned the house down, I'll never understand. But it was a very happy time. Besides sharing all they had with us, Bob and Mag were expansively cheerful. The big excitement came with the start of the first mental hospital group. Bob had been talking to Dr. Russell E. Blaisdell, head of New York's Rockland State Hospital, a mental institution which stood nearby. Dr. Blaisdell had accepted the AA idea on site for his alcoholic inmates. He gave us the run of their ward and soon let us start a meeting within the walls. The results were so good that a few months later, he actually let busloads of committed alcoholics go to the AA meetings, which by then had been established in South Orange, New Jersey, and in New York City. For an asylum superintendent, this was certainly going way out on a limb. But the alcoholics did not let him down. At the same time, the AA meeting was established on a regular basis in Rockland itself. The grimmest imaginable cases began to get well and stay that way when released. Thus began AA's first working relation with a mental hospital. Since duplicated more than 200 times, Dr. Blaisdell had written a bright page in the annals of alcoholism. In this connection, it should be noted that 3 or 4 alcoholics previously had been released into AA from Jersey's Greystone and Overbrook asylums, where friendly physicians had recommended us. But Dr. Blaisdell's Rockland State Hospital was the first to enter into full-scale cooperation with AA. Lois and I finally recrossed the Hudson River to stay in New York City. Small AA gatherings are being held at that time in newcomer Bert's tailor shop. Later, this meeting moved to a small room in Steinway Hall, and thence into permanent quarters when AA's first clubhouse, the Old 24th, was opened. Lois and I went there to live. As we look back over those early scenes in New York, we saw often in the midst of them the benign little doctor who loved drunks, William Duncan Silkworth, then physician-in-chief of the Charles B. Towns Hospital in New York, a man who was very much a founder of AA. From him, we learned the nature of our illness. He supplied us with the tools with which to puncture the toughest alcoholic ego, those shattering phrases by which he described our illness, the obsession of the mind that compels us to drink, and the allergy of the body that condemns us to go mad or die. These were indispensable passwords. Dr. Silkworth taught us how to till the black soil of hopelessness out of which every single spiritual awakening in our fellowship has since flowered. In December 1934, this man of science had humbly sat by my bed following my own sudden and overwhelming spiritual experience, reassuring me. "No, Bill," he had said, "you are not hallucinating. Whatever you have got, you had better hang on to. It is so much better than what you had only an hour ago." These were great words for the AA to come. Who else could have said them? When I wanted to go to work with alcoholics, Dr. Silkworth led me to them right there in his hospital, and at great risk to his professional reputation. After 6 months of failure on my part to dry up any drunks, he again reminded me of Professor William James' observation that truly transforming spiritual experiences are nearly always founded on calamity and collapse. "Stop preaching at them," Dr. Silkworth had said, "and give them the hard medical facts first. This may soften them up at depth so that they will be willing to do anything to get well. Then they may accept those spiritual ideas of yours and even a higher power." 4 years later, Dr. Silkworth had helped to convert Mr. Charles B. Towns, the hospital's owner, into a great AA enthusiast, and had encouraged him to loan $2,500 to start preparation of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, a sum, by the way, which was later increased to over $4,000. Then, as our only medical friend at the time, the good doctor boldly wrote the introduction to our book, where it remains to this day, and where we intend to keep it always. Perhaps no physician will ever give so much devoted attention to so many alcoholics as did Dr. Silkworth. It is estimated that in his lifetime, he saw an amazing 40,000 of them. In the years before his death in 1951, in close cooperation with AA and our red-headed powerhouse nurse, Teddy, he administered to nearly 10,000 alcoholics at New York's Knickerbocker Hospital alone. None of those he treated will ever forget the experience, and the majority of them are sober today. Silky and Teddy were much inspired by Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia at Akron, and will always be regarded as their Eastern counterparts in our pioneering time. These four set the shining example and laid the basis for the wonderful partnership with medicine which we enjoy today. We could not take leave of New York without paying grateful tribute to those who made today's world services possible. The very early pioneers of the Alcoholic Foundation, forerunner of AA's present General Service Board. First in order of appearance was Dr. Leonard B. Strong, Jr., my brother-in-law. When Lois and I were alone and deserted, he, together with my mother, saw us through the worst of my drinking. It was Dr. Strong who introduced me to Mr. Willard Richardson, one of the finest servants of God and man that I shall ever know. This introduction led directly to the formation of the Alcoholic Foundation. Dick Richardson's steady faith, wisdom, and spiritual quality were our main anchors to windward during the squalls that fell on AA and its embryo service center in the first years, and he carried his conviction and enthusiasm to still others who labored for us so well. With selfless care and devotion, Dr. Strong served as secretary to our Board of Trustees from its beginning in 1938 until his own retirement in 1955. Dick Richardson was an old friend and confidant of the John D. Rockefellers, senior and junior. The result was that Mr. Rockefeller Jr. became deeply interested in AA. He saw that we had the small sum necessary to launch our service project, yet not enough to professionalize it, and he gave a dinner in 1940 to many of his friends so that they might meet some of us and see AA for themselves. This dinner, at which Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick and the neurologist Dr. Foster Kennedy talked, was a significant public recommendation of our fellowship at a time when we were few and unknown. Sponsoring such a dinner could have brought Mr. Rockefeller under much ridicule. He did it nevertheless, giving a very little of his fortune and much of himself. Mr. Richardson brought still other friends to our aid. There was Mr. Albert Scott, head of an engineering firm and chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Riverside Church in New York, who presided over the famous meeting in late 1937 in Mr. Rockefeller's office, which was the first gathering of some of us alcoholics with our new friends. Here, Mr. Scott asked the searching and historic question, "Won't money spoil this thing?" Dr. Bob, Dr. Silkworth, and I attended that meeting, and there were present also two more friends of Mr. Richardson's who were destined to exert great influence on our affairs. Early in the spring of 1938, our new friends helped us to organize the Alcoholic Foundation, and Mr. A. Leroy Chipman tirelessly served for many years as its treasurer. In 1940, it seemed desirable for the foundation to take over Works Publishing Incorporated, the little company we had formed to handle the book. And 2 years later, Mr. Chipman did most of the work in raising the $8,000 which was needed to pay off the shareholders and Mr. Charles B. Towns in full, thus making the foundation the sole owner of the AA book and putting it in trust for our society for all time. Recently, Mr. Chipman had to retire from the Board of Trustees because of illness, and to his deep disappointment, was unable to come to St. Louis. Nor could Dick Richardson be with us, for he had died some years before. Present at that early 1940 meeting was yet another of Mr. Richardson's friends, Frank Amos, a newspaper and advertising executive and a trustee of AA, only lately retired. In 1938, Frank went out to Akron to meet Dr. Bob and to make a careful survey of what had transpired there. It was his glowing report of Dr. Bob and Akron's Group Number 1 that had caught Mr. Rockefeller's interest and had further encouraged the formation of the foundation. This foundation was to become the focal point of AA's World Services, which have been responsible for much of the unity and growth of our whole fellowship. Frank Amos was accessible at his office or home in New York at almost any time of day or night, and his counsel and faith were of immense help to us. As we New Yorkers continued to reminisce the small hours away at St. Louis, we thought of Ruth Hawk, the devoted non-alcoholic girl who had taken reams of dictation and had done months of typing and retyping when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was in preparation. She often went without pay, taking the then seemingly worthless stock of Works Publishing instead. I recall with deep gratitude how often her wise advice and her good humor and patience helped to settle the endless squabbles about the book's content. Many an old-timer at St. Louis also remembered with gratitude those warm letters Ruth had written to him when he was a loner, struggling to stay sober out there in the grassroots. Ruth was our first national secretary, and when she left in early 1942, Bobby B. took her place. Bobby, for several years, faced almost single-handed the huge aftermath of group problems that followed in the wake of Jack Alexander's feature article on AA in the Saturday Evening Post. Writing thousands of letters to struggling individuals and wobbly new groups, she made all the difference during that time when it seemed very uncertain that AA could hang together at all. While I was still reminiscing about old times in New York The names of more of my alcoholic friends loomed up. I remembered Henry P., my partner in Works Publishing, and the book Enterprise. Among all the prospects Dr. Silkworth had pointed out to me at Towns Hospital, Henry, in 1935, was the first one to sober up. He had been a big-time executive and salesman, and he turned his really prodigious enthusiasm into the formation of the New York group. Many a Jerseyite can remember his impact over there, too. When, in 1938, the foundation found it could not raise money to publish the AA book, it was largely Henry's insistence that caused us to set up Works Publishing Incorporated, and while we were working on the book, his endless hounding of the subscribers to Works Publishing kept enough money trickling in, barely enough, to finish the job. About that time, there appeared on the New York scene another character, Fitz M., one of the most lovable people that AA will ever know. Fitz was a minister's son and deeply religious, an aspect of his nature which is revealed in his story entitled Our Southern Friend in the Big Book. Fitz fell at once into hot argument with Henry about the religious content of the coming volume. A newcomer named Jimmy B., who, like Henry, was an ex-salesman and former atheist, also got into the hassles. Fitz wanted a powerfully religious document. Henry and Jimmy would have none of it. They wanted a psychological book which would lure the reader in. When he finally arrived among us, there would then be enough time to tip him off about the spiritual character of our society. As we worked feverishly on this project, Fitz made trip after trip to New York from his Maryland home to insist on raising the spiritual pitch of the AA book. Out of this debate came the spiritual form and substance of the document, notably the expression, God as we understood him, which proved to be a ten strike. As umpire of these disputes, I was obliged to go pretty much down the middle, writing in spiritual rather than religious or entirely psychological terms. Fitz and Jimmy were equally ardent to carry the AA message. Jimmy started the Philadelphia group in 1940, while Fitz took the good news to Washington. The first meeting in Philadelphia was held in the home of George S. George was one of AA's first loners. He had sobered up after reading the article Alcoholics and God, written in 1939 by Morris Markey and published in the September issue of Liberty Magazine by its then-editor, Fulton Owsler, who was to do much more for us later on. George's case was a very severe one, even for those days of last gaspers. When the issue of Liberty first arrived, George was in bed, drinking whiskey for his depression and taking laudanum for his colitis. The Markey piece hit George so hard that he went ex-grog and ex-laudanum instantly. He wrote to New York, and we gave his name to salesman Jimmy, who traveled that territory. And that's how AA started in the city of brotherly love.